I tell my learners, I hope you hear my voice in your ear for the rest of your life. When you get that feeling of, oh, I'm stuck, expand the system. How can you pull this outward? Because patients also feel very stuck. Welcome to the Integrated Care Podcast from the Collaborative Family Healthcare Association. I am the production editor, Grace Pratt, and I'm joined by three of my co-hosts today. We have a great episode coming up for you, and we're going to start the way we always do with our icebreaker. But to get to this icebreaker, I have to tell you a little story that actually just happened this morning. So new listeners may not know that I am the mother to identical triplet boys. They're seven. They're in kindergarten this year. And a couple months ago, a teacher stopped me in the hallway when I was volunteering at the school, and she said, I have to tell you something that happened. Apparently, they waited for a day when there was a school assembly, and James and Luke decided to switch classes. So they waited. This was very, you know, it was very plotted out. They're too good. They're too clever for their own good. And they waited until it was a busy day. There was an assembly. They went in the bathroom. They traded clothes. They traded shoes because their shoes look different. They know that people tell them by their shoes. And they had like that hair tinsel in their hair, you know, like the colored little extension thing. And I think Luke's was already out, but James's was still in. So Luke pulled it out for him so that like they wouldn't be able to tell by the hair, which I feel like is a very like parent trap, ear piercing in the cabin moment, right? So then they go back to the assembly, they go back with their classes, they go back to their classrooms. And I asked them, I was like, buddies, how long did it take you? And this happened like a week before, no one told me until the teacher saw me the hall. I was like, how long did it take your teachers to figure out? They're like, they knew right away. And James said, Luke's teacher said, I want my triplet. So now, as good, like iterative thinkers, they're refining their plans. And this morning they were talking about, okay, our problem was the teachers knew us too well already. So next year, we're not going to trade on the first day because like the first day of school, we got to get to know our teachers. We got to get to know our friends. But the second day, we're going to trade classes. And part of me wants to tell them like, that, you know, that's not right. We need to be honest. And part of me wants to be like, guys, you're triplets. The third day would clearly be the most iconic. But anyway, TBD what happens there. But it led me to wonder, long story long, for our icebreaker question, if you could trade lives with someone, like pop into somebody's job, pop into their life for a day, anybody like living, probably somebody right now, who would you trade with? So we're going to go clockwise around my little circle here on Zoom. And first we have Neftali Serrano.
Hey everyone, I am Neftali Serrano, or Neftali Serrano, whichever way you're able to say it. And I'm the CEO here at the Collaborative Family Healthcare Association. I'm really excited about today's topic. And actually my answer to the icebreaker will be a little bit meta. So I would like to switch places with my wife. The reason is because, you know, we've been married for 25 years and I still don't know what goes through the head of that woman. She sees the world in such a different way than I do. And every time I think like we got it or I got it, you know, I understand how this is going to work and, you know, I get, you know, what, you know, we're in sync. Then there's like some thing that comes up or some way she sees something or some way she sees parenting or our future or whatever. And I realize I just like, I don't get it. And that's a good first step for me. I think that I realize I'm accepting that part. So I just would like to just live in her mind for one day, probably not too much longer because I don't think I'd survive that long, but just one day and figure out like, hey, how does this person see this person that I respect, this person that I love, but also this person that I
you want
clearly
the secret
misunderstand.
Code. You're trying to figure out the secret sauce.
I'm missing something here.
An exercise in perspective taking. I love it. And Bridget, he wants to get more of her context so he can understand.
Yep. Hey, you know it.
I love that. And next round the circle, we do have Bridget Beachy, our context queen.
Yeah. My name is Bridget, and I'm a BHC director out in Washington State, all things primary care, behavioral health, integrated care. And I don't think this is going to come to a shock to anybody. This is completely on brand. LeBron James, yeah. I just want to see what would it be like to be the best in the world at something while being, I know people don't think this, but I think he's humble. He has the same partner since he had in high school. He's a father to three kids. He does the right things. He gives back to schools. I know he might flop or whatever, that people have their issues with him, but he's a philanthropist. He's a producer. And so I just wanted to see, like, what is his day like? You know, like, what is his routine? I have read a lot about it. I know he takes a lot of naps. He has spent $1 million on his body with, you know, between the training and massage and nutrition. So he's just an elite human, and he stayed, not that we know everything, but he stayed, I feel like, a good person. So it just endlessly fascinates me. And I just want to know what that would be like.
What's funny about that is you went the nice route of how he takes care of his body. And I went to, oh, his family's Taco Tuesdays seem amazing.
That's true.
You know, there's a whole range of human experience wrapped up in there. You just heard her voice, but next we have Monica Harrison.
Hello, everyone. Monica Harrison, licensed clinical social worker, clinical trainer, and practice coach with the AIM Center out of the state of Washington, but I'm in Connecticut, soon to be a North Carolinian. I'm trying to wrap my head on around that part. I instantly, when I heard this question, thought absolutely no one, because you would be surprised at the number of things that other people have to deal with that you just have no clue. And I don't want to take on anybody else's, like, my own stuff is enough, the good stuff and the bad stuff. Right? Like, my own stuff is enough. And so I was instantly like, nobody. I'm a little bit scared to think about what might come my way, because I'm thinking about this good piece I want to see into the world of someone. And their bad stuff comes with that too. So I'm going to just stay right here where I am. I'm good right here dealing with my stuff, playing my cards I was dealt. I am good.
Monica's like, I'm even in my lane. I'm exactly where I should be.
not even LeBron's Taco Tuesday entices
me. It looks like I'ma just ask Bridget how'd that go. Just ask Bridget how'd it go. Seems fun. Invite me over. That's what I just remember. I'm your friend, and invite me over.
Yeah.
I love it. I didn't have my answer to this question, but as soon as LeBron, you've taken his place apparently. As soon as Bridget started talking about LeBron. Yeah, I thought, well, then I'll be Taylor Swift, right? Like, how fun. See all the behind the scenes. Because it's been almost exactly a year since I was so lucky to get to go see Eras Tour in Dallas. So amazing. I will tolerate no Taylor Swift hating on this podcast. She is incredible. But just to think about, like, all the logistics that go into making that work. And also right now she's on vacation, whatever that looks like for Taylor. She's on a break in her tour. So then that'd be even more fun to, like, live a Taylor Swift vacation versus, like, she's a little bit in a different spot than my vacations. So anyway, that was a fun introduction. We're missing our co-host Jen Thomas today. She is on spring break with her family, and we're looking forward to having her back next month. I didn't actually introduce myself. I'm Grace Pratt. I'm the production editor. I'm behavioral medicine faculty at Great Plains Family Medicine Residency Program in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and really enjoying being a part of this podcast and reflecting on it, because kind of transitioning to our news and notes, Deepu and I, our good friend Deepu George, former co-host for the podcast, current president of the board for CFHA, we are working together on a podcast series, and we're calling it Coming of Age. And we previewed it a little bit with a special segment in our last episode. We have two episodes recorded. We have two more actually scheduled for today. And we have had the most warm, lovely response from our community members who we have asked to tell the story of this organization and how it intersects with integrated care. And it's just really fun. If you've ever watched the YouTube series Actors on Actors, which if you haven't, I highly recommend it. I think it's made by Variety. That's essentially our concept. We're getting together two people who were in the room and having them reflect and talk about like where we've been and where we're going. And it's just been really fun. So we can't wait. We're almost ready to release our first episode of that. I'm not positive if it'll drop before or after this episode that you're listening to does, but it's going to be right along in your regular podcast feed. The episodes will be called Coming of Age, and I'm so excited for you guys to join us up on that. It's been a lot of work, but it's been so fun. Other news and notes, Naftali?
Yeah, so just to dovetail off of that, we've also gotten a lot of fantastic, surprisingly positive responses to direct invites to attend the conference in San Antonio. So for those of you who don't know, our conference this year is in San Antonio, Texas in October. You can find more information at integratedcareconference.com. We've put out some special invitations to the group of folks that we're calling sort of like seminal people in the history of CFHA. So a lot of the folks that were there at the initial conference that was called the Wingspread Conference. And in my mind, I'm like, you know, a lot of these people are not, some of them are retired. Some of them are just not connected to our work any longer or just in different parts of their life. But it's almost been universally like, yeah, I'll be there, which is fantastic. So there's going to be some really fun stuff to celebrate them. And I'm really looking forward to creating a space for them to have fun with each other as they reconnect. I think that's what they're really looking forward to. So news and notes wise, I've got three pieces of news and notes. First up, we just released the second edition of the Implementer's Guide to Primary Care Behavioral Health. Bridget was one of the many authors. It's a really practical manual. So if you're out there and you're in the early stages of implementing, or even early to middle stages of implementing a PCBH program, this is going to give you stories, real world advice, counsel, very, very practical knowledge from existing programs that have made this work. So you can pick that up as an ebook on any of the major retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple, even some others I don't know about. So just search up Implementer's Guide to Primary Care Behavioral Health. You should find it. I'm listed as the editor. So that's first thing. The other two are just sort of FYIs for the community out there. We're constantly trying to improve our community and obviously push our vision for integrated care that's bringing physical and behavioral health together. So one of the things that we've done to do that is we have hired on staff our two co-directors, national co-directors for integrated care. I should say two co-medical directors for integrated care. And our own Jen Thomas, who's on the podcast, is one of them. And Laura Sidari is another one. So we have this awesome pairing of a psychiatrist, that's Laura, and a family medicine physician, that's Jen, who will be leading efforts to connect us to the world of medicine. That's like connecting us to external associations and groups of physicians, and also creating a space within CFHA for those folks to have more of a home. We want to be supporting our physician champions. So keep an eye out. If you are a member, keep an eye out for stuff from them. There'll be some stuff that's open to the public as well that they'll probably end up doing also. But congratulations to Jen and Laura, and congratulations to us. We're happy to have them. And the last thing is just a fun thing that I've been working on the side that I just want people to know about. And you'll be able to see this on TikTok and YouTube Shorts. We're creating a group of shorts on measurement-based care. And we're just like interviewing a bunch of companies that work with measurement-based care, supporting measurement-based care, just as a way of exposing the community to the idea of measurement-based care, why it's important, why it's crucial for the future of value-based payments, why it's crucial for the future of integrated care. So again, that's coming out on TikTok and YouTube Shorts. We got to figure out a way probably to put it on Instagram Reels also, but at least those two platforms. So keep an eye out for that stuff. So lots of fun stuff going on here at CFHA. That's our news and notes.
Awesome. I got to say, I love the cover of the implementer's guide. It is so, that graphic design, I'll show it for my co-host, anybody watching on YouTube. But it's so cool. The stylized PCBH and the colors and very cool work.
Credit to Liana Edwards. And actually, I committed a boo-boo because the cover was the last piece of the book. And I gave her like a week and a half to get it done. So Liana is our graphic design and marketing person here at CFHA. And so, you know, there's a bazillion details that go into putting a book out. In that, I forgot to give her credit in the book. But that's the nice thing about ebooks. There'll be an update coming out here in about a month or so as I kind of find errors and things like that. And with that, I'm gonna have Liana's name. So Liana, if you're listening, it's gonna be in there. Don't worry. You deserve it. That is a fantastic cover.
The fact that she did it in that amount of time makes it even more impressive. But very cool. Well, thank you for all those news and notes. It's always, you know, really fun to hear about the different things going on in our organization and different things in the world of integrated care. So moving us on to our main topic, also brought to you by my personal life. Talked about the kids for our icebreaker. And then a lot of times when I'm reflecting on like, what are we going to talk about on the podcast? You know, we try to have a mix of big picture, like larger systems topics, you know, current events or things going on. But also there, you know, one of my selfish, I have a few selfish reasons for loving being in this role. One is getting like this defined time to sit and talk with brilliant people every week, every month. And I just feel like inspired and connected. It's so fun. But second of all, I like to create tools that I can share with my learners. And, you know, we have a few different podcasts that really fall under that lens of things that I'm like, hey, I want to be able to point my behavioral health learners or my resident learners to this episode and say, go listen to this and come back and talk to me and let's discuss it. And this is one of those times. So the personal life piece of it, you know, and also the relevant clinical topic. But anyway, long story long, again, I'm feeling very talkative today. Apparently, I got engaged last week. And I am just super thrilled and happy and excited to be, you know, in this exciting time in our family. But it did make me think about, you know, some of the work that we do in integrated care. And when we talk about being family-centered, when we talk about, you know, I work in family medicine, as many of our collaborators do, although I think so. I ended up having a really interesting conversation recently about moving into specialty care, but which we have definitely some representation of that in our organization as well. But when we're talking about family medicine, especially, and we talk about these family relationships, family medicine doesn't just mean cradle to grave, you know, birth to end of life, but it also means systems and it means families and being able to be the system that's caring for a family unit. And I think there are ways that we do that really well. And then there's ways that we struggle or we forget because we have so many competing demanding pressures. We have the time pressure. We have the, you know, broad spectrum of issues that people are presenting with that we're trying to address. And, you know, we've talked on this podcast a lot of times about ways that we filter through that, ways we get straight to the functional aspect of what's going on for someone, ways that we get to kind of the core of placing that next brick of intervention for them instead of building the whole wall and the longitudinal relationship of integrated care. But I wanted to kind of put our spotlight a little bit on couples today. We have a couple of podcasts in the past that are relevant to this. You know, I was looking back and in September of 2020, we talked about like pregnancy and perinatal health and integrated care, which is relevant, you know, a lot of times to couples. In February of 2019, we talked about sex and integrated care. So that was a fun, spicy conversation. So those are relevant, but not wholly here. So we're talking about, I would love for us to just talk about couples. You know, how does it come up in our practice? How do we see that as teams and in integrated care? And, you know, what's our experience been there for me to start us off, you know, if we're talking about like some of the barriers or some of the challenges with working with couples, is couples work, and maybe this is partially because I'm trained as a marriage and family therapist, and you know, we all come into these roles with a little bit different background and experience. And you know, for many MFTs, couples work is this like holy grail of work. They're like, oh, I want to work with couples. And what they mean is I want to do like long-term relationship-based, like affair recovery, or, you know, really reworking the deep parts of these relationships. And many MFTs in particular think of couples work in this way. And in fact, a lot of MFTs have in traditional settings have like a different billing structure, a different time structure for couples sessions. They go, the 50 minutes isn't even enough. They do an hour and a half couple sessions, or, you know, there's lots of different ways to do it. But then how does that, so in some ways, I think it feels like even more of a separation, even more of a distinction from what we're doing in primary care, integrated care, whatever setting we're seeing these people in an integrated care collaborative environment. So just want to throw that out as a barrier, but I'm curious to hear like what bubbles to the top for you as we start talking about couples and integrated care.
Yeah, I think I'll just jump in with another preparatory comment, because you were saying how we don't do a good job of it, and because it's like time and that, but I think it's actually more than that. I think it's actually the structure of how we provide care in primary care is not set up for families or couples. And so it's like when I'm in those situations clinically, I find myself having to like very intentionally think about including the family or including the partner. The system is not incentivizing that in any way. It's actually presenting barriers. When I go to document, I'm like, okay, who's the identified patient here? How do I document in a way that doesn't like put information about the other person that could be, you know, hurtful or damaging or whatever? You know, so there's all these steps along the way that keep me from naturally including that. So if it, just for an exercise for the audience, if you just think about it, even with just some, with something like diabetes, which to me is one of the more obvious ones for family-based intervention, you know, there's nothing in protocols, there's nothing in the systems like the appointment-based systems that would actually incentivize you to have a visit with the entire family for diabetes, even if there's multiple diabetics in the family, right? So that's an example of like the structure is actually not supporting that. So it takes the clinician to do an extra step, to do something extra, to be more mindful. And anytime you have that, it's not going to happen consistently, right? So this is just a side note on that. So the same thing I think is true of couples, where a lot of times there are some issues that someone's bringing in that are based on their relationship. And it takes extra work for me to kind of think, okay, how do we involve the partner in this situation? How do we make this work in this setting? And I have lots of thoughts about working with couples, but I'd like to hear from the rest of you all about your thoughts about how you've actually done it, because I imagine that there's a lot of variation in how we've approached these situations and what kind of situations are presenting. I'm really curious to see from Bridget and Monica, like what kind of stuff have you worked in primary care?
Yeah, system barrier. The other part to that, and then I will answer or speak on Neftali's question. The other thing to that I see come up a lot, even most recently, but this was maybe like a month or two ago on the listserv, on the CFHA listserv that's come up, is individuals, the way that we are trained in our silo training about conflict of interest, right? And so I know what has come up on the listserv is like, well, I'm seeing this patient, so, well, no, I can't, I might be the only clinician in the clinic, so no, I can't also see their partner, like, I can't do that. What are we going to do? What does everyone have in their policies, right? Like, everyone hits the listserv up, rightfully so, for what resources people have and bring to the table, but I add that into, like, so that's a system barrier to me, and how we are all trained in our individual discipline silo, that we're not thinking about what the patient needs, what the family needs are. Does the person want their partner to come into the session? Are you willing to allow that to happen? Or are you nervous about that because you weren't trained in couples and now all of a sudden you see this as a couple situation? And so I'm not going to call nobody else out. I'm going to call myself out. And that I had that situation when I first started out in integrated care. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. So yeah, we've taken courses on, but that's not our foundation. Our foundation is not working with families. Or couples. We do have families and family system stuff, but couples specifically was like, okay, wait now. And I had a patient who identified as lesbian, and the issues that she was bringing up, she wanted her partner to come to the session. So I had two things happening for me. One, couples was not my jam. That's one. Two, I cannot tell you anything about being a lesbian because I do not identify as a lesbian. So now I had these two things that I was like, oh, wait, I'm not going to be able to help her do this. I don't know, right? Like, it was all my internal fears of inadequacy. I'm not going to get it right. You know what? Well, I'm not even supposed to do this anyway because I'm in the primary care setting and we don't do couples. That's not what we do. We see patients that are assigned to providers, right? Like all the things I could think of why not to have this happen. I did ended up seeing them because my thing is I owned, like, listen, definitely bring your partner in. Now I want to be really clear. I do not have a lot of experience in working with couples that identify as lesbian couples. So I wanna just put that out there. And she was like, no, I completely get it. I said, but what I do feel like it is all about communication and relationship and how you all are communicating with each other and what barriers or things that are coming up for your relationship and what expectations you have for your relationship. Because at the end of the day, it's a relationship. So I did end up seeing them and it went outside of what my agency at the time had for us in terms of who we were supposed to see, how long we were supposed to see them, what we were supposed to be working on. It did go outside of that.
It's interesting. I love that we're even starting this conversation talking about some of the larger systems issues that make this difficult in terms of billing codes, in terms of training backgrounds, in terms of the way that the system is set up. And I'm also hearing, you know, this really mindset shift, I think, that happens and that I see happen as clinicians become more mature in integrated care, in this way of working, in terms of we kind of start out by talking about all the things we can't do. Or we talk about, you know, a new content area comes up and we're like, oh, well, I don't know what to do with that. I've never seen that before. And not that we shouldn't, you know, recognize the boundaries of our experience and the limits of what we are prepared for. But when we start to move towards thinking about process over content, you know, when we start, what you identified there, Monica, like, I don't have a lot of experience working with couples and especially not lesbian couples, but also I do know about like relationship and communication and how that impacts like this broader biopsychosocial spiritual view of health. When we keep our eye on those things, then it translates over into, you know, opportunities for intervention and connection and support. Because I think there are some issues that present that are so based in the relationship and they come to integrated care, they come to, you know, see their doctor for this challenge that they're facing. And when we're like, oh, well, that's going to be this thing over there, but we're this thing over here, then we're doing the thing that we've argued against and the thing that we are really trying to fight against. And so thinking about like, what is the process? What do I know? Where do I go back to connecting? And sometimes that starts really simply. And I know that my learners are guilty of this. And I think but a lot of seasoned clinicians are guilty of this too, of seeing family members as kind of an accessory to the treatment that's going on. So I go into this room to see this patient and there's a family member there. And maybe I say hi to them and acknowledge them. Maybe I don't even acknowledge them, which is a bigger problem. But this person, there's so many opportunities that this is a source of support. This is a source of connection. This is potentially a source of dysfunction and barrier. But if we're not addressing that and we're not opening ourselves to what's going on between people and not just within them, then we're losing this whole rich opportunity for connection and working with patients.
Yeah, I think that one of the most important things, like you're saying, as a clinician, is to be really steeped in the culture of the setting that you're working in. And so when you're stuck, you do what the setting does. And so in family medicine, which is where I also work, is people are bringing in all kinds of people all the time, friends, family, a neighbor, caregivers, like care providers, and, you know, partners. And so I try to approach it not distinctly as a separate thing. I try to approach it very, very organically. I agree with Neftali that the system isn't necessarily set up for it. So if in doubt, I do like the thing that's the easiest, which is you place the majority under the identified patient. And then, you know, you speak on a few things and document enough to have your note pass type of deal. But when I'm stuck, I do what primary care does. And because the relationship of a person is way as a, you know, functional contextualist and as a behaviorist is so primary to how I'm already addressing things. It's the second question on the contextual interview, which most of the time with the first question, which is a living situation, you're going to get a bunch of information from that. And your second question is the relationship, and not just the relationship like, oh, do you have one? It's, well, when did it start? How is it going? Is it a source of support? Is it a source of stress? Is it the regular stress, or are we talking about something dangerous here? Is it the regular ups and downs, or, you know, that's so fundamental to where I'm already coming from. I don't feel like I'm then doing something different, because I already recognize as a clinician that in our Western culture, the most common, most important relationship for the majority of people is their partner. Right, wrong, good, bad, fair, not fair. That's how our society is largely set up. And so I think, how could the hell could you work on anything if you don't know what's going on between the two of them? And like you guys are saying, you miss out on a huge area for fodder for intervention, as well as understanding where barriers are. And when you're crafting your customized instruction in your after visit summary of like, what are they going to go do if you're not taking that into account? So, and maybe I'm more comfortable with it because I had a ton of training in graduate school from like couples workshops. Dave and I were part of this whole movement about providing workshops to couples in Southwest Missouri. And so it wasn't therapy, but it was skill-based. And so that kind of just goes very naturally with what we're doing in PCBH. Not that we're not going deep with the relationship, but I felt very comfortable in the words of grace, helping people lay a brick with the relationship skills. So I would say if you work in integrated care, the best thing you can do would probably take some courses and some webinars that look at strategies and behavioral strategies that you can use with families and couples, and get very well versed in that. And then definitely pursue some type of, whether it's systems or contextual approach, of really looking at the context from which people are coming from.
And I'll give a couple of examples, I think, of what you're talking about, Bridget. And I should give the caveat that I feel like I struggle with this a fair amount. It's by struggle, I mean, like, I feel the tension in the room when I'm realizing, I need to, like, look at context, and I need to kind of, you know, how do I bring in this person's partner if they're willing to come in, that kind of a thing. So it's just, that's because the system's not set up for it. So you have to kind of go against the grain somewhat in that sense. But I had two couples I can think of right off the top of my bat just in the last month. So one is an example of a couple who both witnessed violence. They were at a store. The husband goes into the store. She stays in the car, and there's a shooting that happens right there in the parking lot. And, you know, so both of them are traumatized Only one of them is a patient of our clinic. So the wife is a patient of our clinic. The physician refers the wife, but the wife brings the husband there. And initially I'm like, okay, great. Husband's here to support wife. No, husband's traumatized too. So, you know, I realized in that situation, like, it makes absolutely no sense for me to work on the acute traumatic reaction. And she's having all the classic symptoms, nightmares, you know, startle reflex, all that stuff. Makes no sense for me to work with just her. Like, it's like, now he's not a patient, but I had them both in the room. And I said, as soon as I figured that out in my head, to Bridget's point, I was like, context is going to drive whether this is going to work. If this is going to work, it's going to work because both of these folks are able to overcome the acute stress reaction that they are having here. And we don't want this to turn into formalized PTSD for either of them, because that's going to affect both of them, right? So I made it clear and I said, hey, look, I know you're the patient here, but I'm going to work with both of you here, because what's going to work for one is going to work for both, and you're going to need to work on this together. And so we did some basic interventions around dealing with acute stress and trauma around that. So sometimes you're going to be able to work with both, but I also want people to think couples work is also not just with the two people in the room. Like, you can do some work, and a lot of the work that I do is actually with the one person, because the other person doesn't want to come in, or the person doesn't want that person to come in. And so, I worked recently with a woman who had a horrible abuse history in her background, and never really talked about it with anybody. And she was concerned about how that was affecting her relationship with her current partner. And so that's part of what we're working on, is just unpacking that and helping her figure out, like, what the impact is and how to distinguish between the stuff that may be connected to kind of your experience of trauma versus just, no, this is just normal communication stuff between couples, right? And in that situation, she doesn't really want the other person to come in. She just wants to get help for herself. But I'm really working with both of them, and I'm helping her, giving her strategies about how she can talk with her partner about these things and involve her partner in supporting her in this. So
that good
just
old,
some tangible ways.
That good old systems concept, that a change in one part affects a change in the whole. Right. There is some technical nuance that comes up a little bit. I mean, as you're talking about working with both partners, where she's a patient but he's not, and you're doing this parallel work with both of them, it raises some logistical questions about documentation, about consent, about how we're keeping up with that. And I think there's some nuance. There's a little bit of kind of different ways to approach this that maybe aren't fully right or wrong. For our system personally, this does come up quite a bit, where we have, a patient and they want to bring in a family member, whether it's a parent, a child, or, a couple. And one of the people is a patient in our clinic and one of them is not. And if we're doing subsequent sessions, so it's one thing to have, a one-off integrated care warm handoff where the family member is there. But if we're doing subsequent sessions in our system, I have my team set the other family member up as a patient in our EMR for documentation purposes. And for me, the reason for this becomes, now most of our documentation probably could, in that situation you were talking, I'm just going to use that as an example, Neftali, where you're doing intervention with both of them. And short-term trauma treatment for us, for them, would look like education about trauma and traumatic reactions, education and working through learning about stress response and relaxation, learning about some work to sort of come together as a couple to kind of navigate those symptoms and that foundation. But what can happen, and what I think a lot of maybe therapists who haven't done a lot of relational care before can start to think about, maybe not think about, is what if the husband that's not the patient does in a session disclose that he's having thoughts of self-harm, Or what if, you know, they do disclose something that is more individual pathology that then we need to take action around, especially when it comes to safety, that doesn't need to be documented in her chart. And so we need to have a place to capture that information that maintains his privacy. And that also allows us to be ethical in our documentation. And then I'm just going to call it what you said in the chat, Monica, is that the first thing that she said she heard in her head when I said that was leadership saying, can we bill for it? And that, you know, that's part of the nuance of the system that you're in, right? And whether leadership, like what they will allow you to do or what you don't, or where we can make exceptions. And I think that's a point too, where we can put it back on them and say, go push for relational codes, go push for us being able to bill for this, because no, we can't. But also, like, in this sense, we have to be documenting, especially like if there is a potential that a safety concern could come up, he's got to have his own chart. But these sort of, like, if we follow this trail, there are threads that pull out from it and that we have to think about considerations. But, you know, what I hope that we don't do is be like, oh, it's just too many things. Never mind. It's too much work. We're just not going to do that as like a blanket policy, because it doesn't do a service to our patients, to our community, when we're just like, meh, sorry, not my patient.
And I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, but I wouldn't necessarily advocate for a complete lack of boundaries, right? I am not a couples therapist. And I'm not going to turn our PCBH practice into a couples therapy center. So I definitely think that once I recognize that there's my sense, I call this like prognosis, right? So if you think about like, what's the trajectory of care here? A lot of times in PCBH, what I'm looking at is, how can I help this patient, help this family make progress, right? And I think through prognosis, I think, where's this headed? So with couples, I think that way. And if the prognosis is, you know, this is a couple that's like on the road to divorce. This is a couple that has they're especially a couple with a lot of high affective issues, right? So like they show you in the exam room a lot of anger and a lot of disdain and a lot of the factors that, you know, are, they're not going to be solved by working on communication. You know, there's going to be a lot more layers there. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to do a disservice to you by working with you in primary care.
That's just a situation. What Richard said, what does the medical side do? Yeah. For our uncomplicated diabetic patients, we see them in-house. For the complicated ones that have failed multiple treatments, or they're going to need a long course of treatment, or they have a unique case, they go to endocrinology. The same thing with couples. If there's a simple thing that we can do, if we can provide support as part of their broader primary care treatment plan, we can treat them in-house. If they need this deep level of work, we need to send them to a couples therapist.
I actually find that people normally don't go, like the folks that need it the most, they don't go. So I'm not saying that strategy isn't, I just take it. I'm here. I'm going to help you in this context. I've already informed consent, said what the structure is. I always talk about what I can do. If they start telling me things that they want that don't line up with it, I have to be honest. Like you, Neftali, you're saying, you have to be very clear. But I always talk about what I can do, because I found that the folks that I, in my head, I start thinking what they need, they ain't never going to go, or they don't have access to it. Or if you're rural, middle of nowhere, rural, there ain't nowhere to go. So, I don't know. I trust you guys. I'm just trying to think of like novice Bridget. I don't know if I would have been able to understand that nuance. And then I feel like I would have been like, oh, this is too much complex. Get them out. Instead of like, you know, seasoned Bridget, where I'm like, look, I told them what I could do and what I can't do. I might have to remind them of it, always say what I can do. If they start requesting something different, then that's my cue. Or like, I want weekly, or I want an hour, or I want this, I want that. That's always my cue. I don't honestly do the prognosis thing personally, you know, just a little rumbles or whatever, because what I think and what people need and what they think they need are so far mismatched and misaligned at times that I found that I just show up, help them, tell them what I do. And then if they're asking for something different, then they can pursue something different, because we're just wrong about a lot of shit as clinicians. And the most of the time, unfortunately, they come in for one psychotherapeutic visit anyways. So show up, give them your best, and don't worry about getting them somewhere else until they're asking for it. Well, unless you have easy access and they're asking for it.
Well, I think the other thing with this is that whole premise, you know, I remember when I was first starting out and we were trying to get providers to just do screening, right, for particular things. And I remember multiple providers' train of thought was, well, I don't want to ask those questions because then I have to do something about it and I don't know what I could do, right? And so to me, it kind of goes back to when we were talking about the questions that you're asking in your contextual, like, are you even asking about their relationship, about how, you know, like, are you even asking, or are we not asking because, okay, they're going to tell me, and then, like, then what? I'm going to have to do something about it, or, okay, I'm going to write it down, but then I'm, like, going to move on with the stuff that we normally do. So I think it still goes to that. One of the things that I actually had some conversation where I work, there's the triangle for collaborative care, and there's an adapted one for pediatrics that has, like, this box to the side that talks about, like, not just communicating with the caregiver, but it's, like, the school and the grandparents and the, like it's a list of like all these other people to consider in this child's life and ask about and da da da. And my thing is, why don't we have that for our adults too? Like, there's a whole host of things that our adults are doing outside the normal walking to your office, a whole host of relationships, organizations they're involved with, all of these things that if you don't ask, you won't know. The assumption sometimes is that patients won't tell us. The truth is, if you don't ask, then you won't know.
That's the thing. And I think we have to invite people to open up their understanding of what we can do and what the purpose of integrated behavioral health is. Because it's not just about screening for depression. It's not just about helping someone take their medication and lose weight and quit smoking. It is so much more broad than that. And one of the things that I hope is my legacy of every single person that ever learns from me, whether it's in my job or on the podcast or anywhere else, is that you hear my voice in your ear when you feel stuck saying, expand the system, expand the system. If you are stuck working with this person, if you are stuck with you, like, they're not changing, or you're not sure what to do next, or like things just feel kind of gross, either bring in another collaborator or invite them to bring a family member or work with a larger system like the school or another community thing that they're plugged into. But we've got to be expanding the system, because the answers are not just this one-to-one whatever. It's about bringing it out. And so that's one thing always that I want anybody, that's what I tell my learners, I hope you hear my voice in your ear for the rest of your life. When you get that feeling of, oh, I'm stuck, expand the system. How can you pull this outward? Because patients also feel very stuck. And a lot of times aren't even considering the opportunity or considering the possibilities of what can be.
I was just going to amplify that. I think another way to say what you're saying is lean in. When you feel stuck, lean in. And that goes to Bridget's point as well. It's like, yes, and when you working with couples is hard because of the complexity of the people in the room and the dynamics they're bringing. Yes, it is hard. When you feel that, you got to lean in and you got to ask yourself really strategic questions. And the way to do this well in PCBH specifically is don't use time as an excuse. I hate it when people say, like, well, we don't have enough time. There's not enough time to do all this stuff. No, there is time. You just have to make mindful choices. What are you choosing to focus on? What are you choosing to get accomplished? How specifically are you targeting a particular piece of functioning or a particular skill set or something? It's just, you just have to make those choices. And that includes the notion of, hey, the main thing I need to focus on is this systemic component today, right? That's the main thing, right? As opposed to thinking you can do the whole shebang today, right? Well, yeah, if you want to try to get the whole shebang, you need 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Right, really.
So I want to plug just kind of resources. Like we've been talking a lot about bigger picture, a lot about the philosophy of why we need to do this. But if someone's like, okay, but I still feel a little stuck, some things that you can do, first of all, is know a little bit about issues that might present more couple-y focus. So like infertility or the whole peripartum, postpartum pregnancy period, or, you know, periods of grief and loss and end of life situations, or, you know, intimate partner violence or sexual issues. So know a little bit about those things so that you can have some feelings of competency and mastery when those content areas do come up. Also, there's an excellent resource. So Dan Felix is out in North Dakota, and he is an LMFT PhD, works in family medicine, and he developed with a team this form called the Family-Centered Observation Form. And it's a teaching tool. It's kind of very similar to the patient-centered observation form, if you're familiar with that one. But it breaks down, what does it look like to do a good encounter with family? And I think if someone's thinking about where could I improve a little bit of my family skills, where could I be more, you know, really systemic and not just seeing the family member as an accessory to these encounters, even just looking through that form and doing a bit of a self-evaluation, how am I doing here? Where can we kind of improve these skills could be really helpful. And they have some great, the form is available online for free. There's a great training website that they have with some videos and things. So definitely recommend that. And just what Bridget said, you know, seeking out opportunities for, you know, where can we lean into family skills, couple skills, relational skills? Where can I pull some of those things into my tool belt so that you don't feel stuck and lost when this starts to come up? So we're already out of time. Oh, go ahead.
No, there's so much to talk about, but I want to also say that a lot of the stuff that I've been dealing with lately is also just developmental issues in couples, which is really interesting. So just learning a little bit about stages in relationships and how, like, when a couple like myself get to midlife, there's a whole different dynamic that comes out. And, you know, you start learning why it is that couples at 25 years might separate, right? Because it's like there's these junctures, right? So just learning little bits, there's so much you can do with a little bit of just mindful learning about it. It's not, you know, don't think that you have to be a vaunted MFT like Grace to be helpful in these situations.
We need just enough content to do psychoeducation, to know the right questions to ask, to be able to build on what's going on for our patients, to lay that one brick, build that one piece, thinking about this longitudinal perspective of patients and their whole health. It's a fabulous conversation again. I'm so thankful to get to spend this time with you guys this month and every month that we get to see each other. Thank you so much for your contributions. Thank you for our listeners. Be on the lookout for that coming of age series coming to you very soon. And we'll be continuing throughout the year until our 30-year celebration in San Antonio this fall. Thank you, Bridget and Monica and Naftali. Thank you to our listeners. And we'll talk to you again next month.
Nice.
I could have gone on. That was a great conversation.
I know.
Yeah. I'd love to.
Should we do a part two? Maybe we could.
Probably.
You know.
Even though we're like, you don't need content. We didn't really get into the content part of it. Maybe that's the part two for next time.
Yeah. I think that'd be great. Yeah. Because we talk about the psychoed. What would one brick look like?
TBD. We'll do that next month.